Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. The annual termination of the silly summer season is, of course, Labor Day. The grim notice that sun and fun frolicking are spent for another annuity. Back to work, wage slaves. I start today's program with a labor treatise that I wrote for my once upon a time press rag, the North Coast Times Eagle. Labor's Labor Lost. And I start with a quote by Thomas More. Born to be slaves and struggling to be lords. Labor Day means little more than a final three-day holiday that ends the silly summer season. Once it celebrated working people, but now that is a joke. Unions do not march on Labor Day anymore, and the few who put on a show are merely window dressing. Andrew Levson wrote in The Working Class Majority that clichés about the USA as a classless society are, quote, exposed as hollow by the simple fact that American workers must accept serious injury and even death as part of their daily reality, quote, unquote. Every year, at least 100,000 workers are killed or die of work-related accidents or disease. 40,000 or so are disabled, and about 6 million are hurt at work. Imagine the universal outcry that would occur if every year several corporate headquarters routinely collapsed, crushing 60 or 70 executives, Levison wrote. Or suppose that all the banks were filled with noxious dust that constantly produced cancer in the managers, clerks, and tellers. Finally, try to imagine the horror if thousands of university professors were deafened every year or lost fingers, hands, sometimes eyes, while on their jobs. Quote, unquote. The power of American labor unions as a force to represent and protect the rights and persons, as well as jobs, in American industry has faded over the past decades, and certainly in this new millennium. This erosion of social and political equity of people who produce the gross national products of the American market is due in part to an increasing global economy and to international competition and ease of capital flight. Union strike power is vulnerable to diversified mega corporations, especially in highly automated industries, and virtually powerless to halt overseas relocations. Union busting has decimated some of the country's largest and formerly strongest unions. Labor law has failed to protect workers, and government acts as a tool for the company. Corporations breach labor laws and are not held accountable. Union strikers are arrested and heavily fined. The bitter assault by government and industry has crippled union power to such an extent that unions are unable to gain significant wage raises or protect the jobs of hundreds of thousands who are sacrifices to company mismanagement, downsizing, or divestiture as a result of incessant corporate Wall Street-inspired takeovers and mergers. The American labor movement succumbed to its own success, and the long-savored revenge of the bosses it temporarily trumped. The power labor gained was immense, was bitterly won, and carelessly lost. When the Reagan administration chose to attack in the early 1980s by breaking a strike by aircraft controllers and forever barring the strikers from government work. It was aware the labor movement was weak and unable to resist a savage campaign of union busting. Unions were by then little more than huge bureaucracies. They had lost contact with their rank and file. Their leaders were raised to social levels with salaries plus perks equal to executives of equal rank. Dissent was usually squelched within the locals, while union and corporate officials colluded on the same class level. For members of most unions, mandatory duties were and remain a tax on their wages. At the same time, they were denied meaningful or coherent representation. The corporate class bitterly resented the labor movement's power and exacted savage revenge throughout the Reagan-Bush senior years, attacking unions in their shops like wolves circling downed beasts. The older industrial unions were ripped apart. Thousands of workers were forced to take huge pay cuts, and the loss of medical and insurance benefits to keep their jobs in industries that were crippled, dismantled, or sold off. Many thousands more were laid off when plants closed or relocated to the Third World. Communities that depended on smokestack or sold off industries paid huge ransoms of public money, essentially, to keep them operating or to attract newer ones. Top echelons of corporations dismantled their subsidiaries to protect their headquarters bastions from corporate raiders, in the meantime, feeding on each other in a frenzy of takeovers. Their unions gutted and powerless to protect them. American workers were pawns and generally losers in the bloody corporate wars. Disinherited at the same time, American corporations employed foreign labor to make their products at cheaper cost. The new realities of world commerce aggravates the problems affecting American labor. American corporations subsidize cheaper labor and manufacturing costs in third world countries by ordering finished products from them instead of producing domestically, which adds not only to imbalance of trade, but shrinks the number of jobs for American workers. Real work shifts overseas, where the only competition is in degrading wages and increasing production, especially among young women reminiscent of U.S. sweatshops in the early part of the 20th century, and more recently in the Pacific Southwest. As the American working force shrinks, the power of the already weakened unions is further eroded. Workers in need of work accept low-paying and non-union jobs and lose their rights and protection. Trotsky was right when he said that labor must be universal rather than national, because corporate industry is global. Jobs are cut in the USA and exported offshore to third world countries with non-existent or harassed labor movements. Violations of international workers' rights are used for competitive advantage by U.S. corporations that are searching the world for impoverished countries with low-wage workers, even employing slave and prison labor while engaging in destroying labor movements and imprisoning or murdering labor leaders. Unions once were, in the words of Kurt Vonnegut, admirable instruments for extorting something like justice from employers. But labor is badly wounded, and its history is treated like pornography. Strikes are crippled with injunctions, and workers are denied government aid while on strike. Union busting has frightened union leaders into painful compromises and binding agreements are torn up by management. Political solutions which workers' rights and union democracies, in its broadest sense, are guaranteed, are necessary. A generous concept of labor democracy would give workers more rights, both in collective bargaining and law, and would allow them a voice in investment policy and in such matters as layoffs, plant shutdowns, takeovers, and in selection of top management. The tax code should be revised to credit companies that avoid layoffs in profitable times and give employees a stake in company policy, as well as good medical coverage and broad retraining opportunities. Workers' rights should be manifested in various ways that would prohibit employer interference in their decisions about organizational representations, which should include unions with only a minority of workers, and mandate collective bargaining that leads to solid contracts. Radical changes in labor law must obviously be accompanied with wide involvement of women, Blacks, Asian, and Hispanic Americans, plus physically handicapped and mentally retarded workers, and should focus on a social crusade framed as an extension of American democracy instead of pressure group whining. A special effort should be made to recreate a social justice movement like civil rights in the 1960s. Such a sharply defined crusade would be an initial stage in educating and mobilizing union members. The next objective would be for these members to spread labor's gospel as far as possible in schools, churches, civic meetings, political caucuses. To bring strong political support into the labor movement, more workers need to be organized and be willing to risk and endure long-standing picket lines, like Astoria Mechanics, who lost, did several years ago in Astoria, Oregon. Rebirth of a robust labor movement requires enfranchising women and minorities, the rise of vigorous new leaders untainted by corruption, reversing the decline and increased costs of education, and most importantly, collective action and collective bargaining to halt labor's collapse in post-industrial America. Re-establishment of a union culture in the United States and radical reforms of union laws must be a primary goal, for the good reason that labor and production are at the heart of economic and political health and survival. As the man said, unions are bad, but without them, it's worse. That perception is all too apparent when thousands of workers lose their jobs, the discrepancy in wages and benefits between management and labor is obscene, and the people who have jobs are required to produce more for less pay with little or no job security. The first permanent national labor organization in the United States, the International Typographical Union, acknowledged at its first convention in 1850, quote, "It is useless for us to disguise from ourselves the fact that, under the present arrangement of things, there exists a perpetual antagonism between labor and capital, one side striving to sell their labor for as much and the other striving to buy it for as little as they can." And that was something I wrote. Labor's labor lost. And now, child labor, not gone, but forgotten. Millions of children trapped between extreme poverty and the profits of others. And it was written by Lou Gatile. In a report written by Lee Tucker, a consultant to Human Rights Watch, about the problem of bonded labor in Asia, a young girl shared, "My sister is 10 years old. Every morning at 7, she goes to the bonded labor man, and every night at 9, she comes home. He treats her badly. He hits her if he thinks she is working slowly, or if she talks to the other children. He yells at her. He comes looking for her if she is sick and cannot go to work. I feel this is very difficult for her. I don't care about school or playing. I don't care about any of that. All I want is to bring my sister home from the bonded labor man. For 600 rupees, I can bring her home. That is our only chance to get her back. We do not have 600 rupees. We will never have 600 rupees, the equivalent of US $17 at the time of writing," quote unquote. These girls' story is heartbreaking. It is unthinkable that a child would be subject to such mistreatment. It is deplorable that stories like this are all too common among the most poverty-stricken portions of the world. It is beyond despicable that an estimated 218 million children as young as 5 years old are employed, and that at least 152 million are in forced child labor, according to Basic Facts About Child Labor, published by the Child Labor Coalition. The facts also reveal several other standing realities about child labor. Among them, children under the age of 12 perform up to a fourth of all hazardous child labor. Almost half of all forced child laborers are between the ages of 5 and 11. More than 134 million children in forced labor are in Africa and the region of Asia and the Pacific. If the 218 million child laborers constituted a country of their own, it would be the fifth largest country in the world, exceeded in population only by China, India, the United States, and Indonesia. What is child labor? It is important to recognize the prevalence of child labor in order to gain a realistic perspective on how pervasive it is. We need to understand the generally accepted definition of child labor. Only then can we comprehend the often irreparable physical and emotional damage inflicted on children, both presently and in their future. Some child labor is innocuous and, in fact, may generally be regarded as positive. The International Labor Organization recognizes that activities such as doing chores around the home, assisting in a family business, or earning pocket money outside school hours and during school holidays, and that's a quote, can also, a quote, contribute to children's development and provide them with skills and experience that prepare them to be productive members of society during their adult life, unquote. Therefore, these activities are not officially considered to be child labor. International law divides child labor into three categories. First, the unconditional worst forms of child labor, defined as slavery, trafficking, debt bondage, and other forms of forced labor, forced recruitment of children for use in armed conflict, prostitution and pornography, and other illicit activities. Labor performed by a child who is under the minimum age specified for that kind of work, as defined by national legislation in accordance with accepted international standards, and that is thus likely to impede the child's education and full development. Labor that jeopardizes the physical, mental, or moral well-being of a child, either because of its nature or because of the conditions in which it is carried out, known as hazardous work. Notwithstanding a few reasonable exceptions, the ILO Convention Concerning Minimum Age for Admission to Employment, adopted in 1973, states that, quote, each member which ratifies this convention shall specify a minimum age for admission to employment or work within its territory, that no one under that age shall be admitted to employment or work in any occupation. The minimum age specified shall not be less than the age of completion of compulsory schooling, and in any case shall not be less than 15 years. Similarly, ILO Convention 182, adopted in 2000, defines the worst forms of child labor as: 1. All forms of slavery or practices similar to slavery, such as the sale or trafficking of children, debt bondage and serfdom, or forced or compulsory labor, including forced or compulsory recruitment of children for use in armed conflict. The use, procuring, or offering of a child for prostitution, for the production of pornography, or for pornographic performances. The use, procuring, activities, in particular, for the production and trafficking of drugs. Work, which by its nature or the circumstances in which it is carried out, is likely to harm the health, safety, or morals of children. Finally, forced labor is defined by ILO Convention 29, adopted in 1930, as, quote, all work or service exacted from any person under the menace of any penalty, and for which the said person has not offered himself or herself voluntarily. Childhood is an essential formative time of life, one which many child laborers must leave too quickly. Their lives may long bear the physical, emotional, and psychological consequences of their early adulthood. Many child laborers, regardless of whether they are considered forced or not, lack the chance of acquiring the knowledge and skills necessary to extract themselves from the poverty they were born or thrust into by circumstances. Many enter adulthood with no means of securing a better life and with few options for jobs, which extends the continuation of generational poverty to their own children. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. Donald Trump proves in spades every day that he is unfit to be president of the USA, blatantly a creature of resident rich fascists who continually betray liberty and justice for all. He is the USA's own Mussolini, a fat, self-indulgent, cowardly hog of privilege and fascist ego, who is serving as president instead of prison as the thief, sexual predator, and consummate liar and criminal felon American jurisprudence has judged him to be. After all, he is not in jail because he is president, a historically terrible judgment that threatens American democracy at its core, and is subject by law for imprisonment once his term in the White House ends, which is no wonder he is pushing for third-term presidency. Obviously, his public statement that Americans might prefer a dictator underlies his pursuit for eternal residence in the White House rather than sentence to the jailhouse.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.